The Chautauqua Institution presents 9 weeks of artistic, educational, and religious programming. This multitude of intellectual activities, along with recreational and leisure activities that abound, make the Chautauqua experience unique beyond description. This cassette is part of an audio program that records the famous Chautauqua morning lectures, the afternoon religion lectures at the Hall of Philosophy, the Sunday morning services of worship in the amphitheater, and other special events. We take you now to Chautauqua, where today's program is about to begin.
For the business at hand, Muhammad Arkun is both a colleague and a friend. And I'm not going to introduce him by giving you a background of all the things that he has done. I think suffice it for me to say three things. One, he is probably today one of the most significant thinkers in the Muslim world, who is giving attention not only to issues of Islamic thought, but to the place of religion and thought in general in all of the monotheistic as well as world religious traditions. He was born in Algeria of Berber background, educated in Algeria and in France, and taught both in Algeria and in France until he became the director of the program in Islamic studies at the Sorbonne. He has lectured and spoken, given seminars and conferences virtually all of the major cities of the world, from Amman to Vancouver and Zurich. He has been visiting professor at all of the major institutions in this country, including Princeton, Temple. He has lectured at most of the significant universities in this country, including virtually all of the Ivy League universities. When I was at Haverford College, it was a joy to welcome him there, except that when I brought him to Philadelphia, six other universities in the area stole him away from us for short periods of time. He has written an enormous amount in Arabic, French, and I'm glad to say more and more in English as well. His work has been translated into 8 or 9 languages, European. His French works have been translated into Arabic, and they cover a whole spectrum from Islamic ethics, Quranic thought, to the role of the people of the book. He has also had a recent work translated, which is available in this country now, called Rethinking Islam. For me, probably one of the most important components of Muhammad Arkun's work is the catalytic role he plays in, first of all, enabling Muslims who are interested in these intellectual issues in rethinking a lot of old assumptions and in being challenged to think of the role and place of religion in the modern world today, and particularly as it affects the great family of Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I'm delighted and privileged to give you Professor Muhammad Arkun.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It is a real privilege to be in this wonderful, peaceful, inspiring place and to speak in the Hall of Philosophy. For me, it's a great opportunity to feel comfortable, because I hope this Hall of Philosophy will inspire us to go as far as possible in tackling a subject which is extremely important for all of us in this end of 20th century. I feel also privileged to address myself to such an impressive, certainly motivated audience about this subject. I have been asked to present to you the evolution and the content of the ongoing dialogue between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. This dialogue has started only in the beginning of the 60s. That's why, as an introduction, we need to look back to the relationships which prevailed through history among Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and then to try to show what has happened during the 60s and why during the 60s there has been a change in these relationships. Let's start from 19th century. During 19th century, the dominating framework of thinking was created in Europe, and of course America here, what we call the West. The thinking then, until the end of the Second World War, was dominated by a conception of reason which was based on the belief in the indefinite progress of humanity through scientific knowledge. And 19th century developed this conception of history applied to religions as well as to cultures and societies based on philological critic of all the ancient texts, including texts of religions, Bible, Gospels, and even the Quran has been included in this search, but it has been included by Orientalists, not by Muslims. Muslims ignored through 19th century, and unfortunately, most of them are still ignoring the importance of philological reading of the ancient texts, of the religious texts. And you know that even in Christianity, when this historical critical reading of the ancient text has been made by scholars in Europe and in America, the Church opposed to it. And there has been a long struggle between the Church and scholarship applied to the reading of the Holy Scriptures. This is one point which is important for us to understand what will happen afterwards for the dialogue. The other point is that, as I say, reason, scientific reason, got a great confidence in itself, and Christianity, in the historical move of Europe to colonize many countries in Asia and in Africa, and among these countries, of course, many Muslim countries, these countries became countries for mission. And we have the word mission in this place, which means that Islam was considered as a religion which does not belong to the true religion as it was defined theologically in Christianity. And Muslims, like animists, like pagans, were considered as people to be converted to the right, the true religion. This is very important. Myself, I have been trained in a school of missionaries in Algeria. We had missionaries in Algeria, like we had missionaries in all Africa. We had missionaries in many other Muslim countries. And this played a role politically in opposing Muslims to Christianity, because Muslims felt diminished by this kind of judgment made on Islam, that Islam cannot be considered as a religion belonging to the same tradition as the religions, the revealed religions, the prophetic religions like Judaism and Christianity. So you see, this is important. And the change of this kind of look to Islam, coming both from culture, from sciences, and from the church in Europe and in America, will change only after the liberation, the political liberation of Muslim countries. From Indonesia to Morocco, all the Muslim countries have been colonized. And they started to be liberated only after the Second World War. That's why after the liberation, there has been an adjustment to the new political situation, and we started to speak about Christian-Muslim dialogue. Another event which is very important to mention here, to clear up the situation, the historical move to dialogue, is that the Church itself, Catholic Church, made a big move with the Concilium of Vatican II, which has been held in 1965. This concilium played a big role because they raised theological issues about plurality of religions which have not been raised until this concilium. Until this concilium, theological thinking with Protestant churches as well as in Catholic Church was exactly the same. It was based on the conception of mission. There is a need for a mission to convert people, including Muslims. This will be changed intellectually and theologically in the beginning of the 60s, after Vatican II for Catholics, and Protestant churches, of course, followed the movement. So you see the picture of the dialogue. It is linked to the intellectual evolution in Europe, to the scientific evolution in Europe, but also to the theological evolution of the Church itself. Now, let's look to the Muslim side of this situation. What was the intellectual cultural situation in Muslim societies after the Second World War? To understand why today it is extremely difficult to engage a dialogue between Christians, Jews, and Muslims on an equal level, one has to look what was the intellectual and cultural situation in the Muslim, in Muslim societies. I said just now that all these societies were under the political control of England, of Holland, of France, of Spain, of Italy, the major European countries. So they could not develop their own system of education. A system of education, a European system of education, has been introduced and gave the possibility for very small elites to benefit from this teaching. But the largest number of the population could not benefit from this modern teaching which was given in Dutch schools, German schools, Italian schools, French schools, English schools. And this will generate a gap between the minorities which could evolve and understand in the new modern culture provided in European schools and the largest number of the population, which was maintained in the traditional thinking and in the traditional conception of religious beliefs. Another aspect which is extremely important to understand the unequal situation, unequal level between Europeans and Muslims, is that Islamic thought since 13th century in the medieval ages didn't evolve to create new possibilities of thinking, new possibilities of knowledge. More than that, Muslim societies, especially in the Mediterranean area, and most of them are included in the Mediterranean area, didn't even take care about the Islamic thought and Islamic civilization which developed previously from 7th century until 13th century. This is a very important point to understand, because it enlightens the situation of today about Islam. It enlightens the way Islam is expressing itself in this second half of the 20th century. You know that from 7th, by the way, maybe it's good to give some dates. Islam as a religion emerged, as you know, in Arabia between 610 and 632. And what Muslims call the revelation, the teaching of the Prophet, lasted 20 years. It was in the beginning of 7th century. Immediately after the death of the Prophet, Islam, the new religion, spread in the Mediterranean area. It reached very quickly Europe, south of Europe. I think Adam Nanji told about this yesterday. The idea I want to put here is that the most brilliant period of Islamic civilization has been in what historians call the High Medieval Ages, the beginning, the very beginning of Medieval Ages, from 7th century to 13th century. In that time, civilization and culture was in Muslim societies, not in European societies. For example, philosophy, in the classical perspective inherited from Greece, was studied in Islamic thought, not yet in European societies. And Europe will start to develop its own culture and thinking after 13th century, in the same time when Muslim societies will withdraw from the historical move towards new civilization, new thinking, new scientific knowledge, etc. And this withdrawal didn't stop until today. So the evolution is just the reverse. While Europe emerged continuously towards more civilization, more culture, more thinking, more inventions, etc., Muslim societies withdrew historically. I have no time to tell you why this happened like this in the Mediterranean area. So this created a big gap between European societies, European culture, European institutions, and Muslim institutions. And after the Second World War, there has been this nationalist movement to get politically free, but getting politically free doesn't mean getting intellectually free, intellectually enabled to catch all what has been built, created, innovated in culture, in sciences, and in the knowledge of the critical knowledge of religions, which happened in Europe and didn't happen in Muslim societies. Now, does this mean today that we are enough equipped intellectually to run not necessarily a dialogue between Muslims and Christians, Muslims and Jews, etc., or a trilogue between all three religions. Are we intellectually equipped to go ahead and to create a new possibility of interpretation for the three religions and not keep, as we do, unfortunately, repeating what each religious community inherited from its own past, from its own teaching, repeating the orthodox conception of Judaism, the orthodox conception of Protestants, the orthodox conception of Catholics, and of course Muslims, without bringing these new intellectual tools which are provided by new social sciences since the last 50s and the last 60s, 70s, and so on. This is the issue. So far, the dialogue which is taking place in many places in the world, mainly between Muslims and Christians, more, unfortunately, between Muslims and Jews, for the reasons you know, which are political again. Although the relationships between the intellectual and cultural relationships between Judaism and Islam are deeper historically, stronger, more significant than with Christianity, which developed in the European line, the Western line, not in the Middle Eastern line, because there is a culture specific to Middle East, as you know. So this is a question. What is happening in the departments of religion or departments of history of religion, which exist almost in each university, each institution of learning in this country especially? This is very well developed. It exists less in Europe, especially in France. Because as you know, France, regarding this problem of religions, has developed a special position, even inside Europe. France, after the French Revolution, has almost eradicated the interest for religion. It's forbidden in France to teach religion at school. Even history of religion, not religion as beliefs, as a faith, but history of religion, it is not taught. In France, we don't have in each university a department for religious studies because of what French call laïcité. Laïcité is this total separation between the church and the state. The church, the state is in the responsibility of running the public space, and the church runs the private space, the private beliefs. And private beliefs cannot come in the public space. So you see, here we have a political issue and we have a philosophical issue about debating on religions and having a dialogue about religions. And in France we have today many problems because of this situation. Because we have, since the last 60s, 4 million Muslims living in France. This is one of the problems, as you see, which is created from inside the evolution, the intellectual and political evolution in Europe itself. This is to show you that the teaching of religions, as we still do it in the universities, is not yet adequate, is not yet conceived in the perspective of providing these new tools to interpret and understand the three religions outside the traditional conservative orthodox theological frames in which still we teach religions. That's why I think, and I am trying to do many things in that way, that we have to provide our universities and our schools with new programs for teaching history, compared history of religions in another perspective than the perspective which is still prevailing in universities. I mentioned universities in Europe and in America. I have to mention the situation in Muslim societies. Unfortunately, for the reasons I mentioned, most of the universities existing in Muslim societies have been created only in the 50s and the 60s, after the independence. Before, it didn't exist. So this explains why still in these universities we do not have yet enough professors, enough resources, enough books even, to provide for the students the possibilities to study, for example, anthropology today. I mention anthropology because it is one of the sciences which is absolutely required today to change our framework of thinking about religions. Without a training in anthropology, without a proper training in linguistics, modern linguistics, as it is taught since the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and today, we cannot read the holy texts other in another perspective, with another epistemology. Let's risk this philosophical word. That's why I told you I'm happy to speak in the hall. It's a protection for us in the hall of philosophy, to change our epistemological posture, to think about religions. We need absolutely linguistics, because we have to read texts. Gospels is a text, the Bible is a text, the Quran is a text. Regardless, as a methodology, regardless to the definitions given by Jewish community, Christian community, Muslim community about revelation, what revelation is for each one of these communities from a strictly theological point of view. I say regardless, I'm not neglecting it, I'm not rejecting it, but I'm trying to say that we have first to clarify, a point of clarification. How should we read the holy texts with a full respect given to linguistics? For example, do we have a linguistic theory of metaphor? Metaphor. The metaphor is the rhetoric figure which organizes all religious discourses, especially the discourse in the Bible, the prophetic discourse, let's say, to include prophetic discourse, to include the discourse in the Bible, in the Gospels, and in the Quran. We don't have yet a reliable theory of the role of metaphor in the religious discourse. And nevertheless, we go on and we make a lot of commentaries, and everyone builds his own theology, and he goes on with his own theology. This cannot be accepted, because reason cannot be satisfied with such a manipulation of texts which have to be respected in their linguistic structures. This is one of the examples. Similarly, if we want to interpret the narrative structure, the narrations which are given in the Gospels, in the Bible, in the Quran, we cannot ignore what anthropology teaches us about myths, because these narrations are mythical narrations. They are not historical narrations. History is different from mythical narration. And we have to read these narrations not according to parables to give sermons and to develop an edification for believers. Okay, this is good. I'm not criticizing it. I'm not rejecting. But it's another work. And I say that we cannot give good sermons. I speak, I know that there are some here who are giving sermons. Yes, it's not, I'm not engaging any polemics. It's, I said, this is a very peaceful place, and we speak very peacefully, and we try to speak scholarly, as a scholar. I'm just putting a point that we cannot go deep in the deepest meaning of these religious texts if we do not respect what anthropologists describe as a mythical narration. Because mythical narration doesn't exist only in religious texts. There is no human culture, there is no human society which is not based on a symbolic presentation of the values in which the society to which the society refers. It doesn't exist. This is what we call the anthropological dimension of a culture. Anthropological because it concerns all human beings, all types of societies, all types of culture. We have to move to this universalizing approach. You see, I say universalizing as an effort to look to all religions, not universal. Up to now, you will hear very often a Catholic, a Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim saying about their respective religions, my religion is universal. My religion is addressed to all humankind. An anthropologist would never say this. He is more humble than a theologian who would say such statements. You see the difference. Now, I know that I have no time to elaborate on these issues. To give you just one example of the kind of intellectual mode and the kind of cultural framework that we have to build all together, I would like to give you this example with this diagram. Unfortunately, those who are there maybe don't see it enough. That's all what we got in this wonderful place, which has everything. So this diagram shows a methodology to include Judaism, Christianity in its branches, and Islam in its branches, because there is all these divisions, Shiaism, Sunnism, etc., like Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, regardless to all this, because these are derivatives from the main branch. But to include the issue of revelation, which is common to these three religions, and the issue of prophetic discourse, which is common to all these religions, and not to stick to the theological developments, as I say. We put this concept, very quickly, Word of God. Word, the Word of God. The Word of God. This Word of God. Here, religious discourse. I don't say Quranic discourse, Gospel discourse, Bible discourse, I include them all. It is religious discourse which has to be studied with the tools and the definitions of linguistics and not of theology. After, theology can come. There is a room for theology, but after, methodologically, after. Here, it's more complicated. Official closed corpus. Official closed corpus, a body of text. Gospels is a body of text. Bible is a body of text. We call it in Latin corpus. Corpus is a Latin word for body. It's a collection of texts which have been collected through history, and at one time the community said this is the authentic corpus. There is no reference to any other text outside the text which officially I recognize. I being the church, I being the imam in Islam, I being the rabbis in Jewish community, etc. And this concept, as you see, when we say official, there is an official intervention. There is an official judgment which will be made. And closed. Closed means you cannot anymore after the decision. Add one word or neglect one word. Finish. Closed. Corpus, the text, which we call the Quran now, which we call the Bible, which we call the Gospels. And you see here the concept clarifies and raises issues which are covered and hidden when we say just the Quran, the Bible, the Gospels, and we go on with our fantasy and our manipulation of the text. It's totally different. And then we have interpretive readings. Interpretive readings. Interpretive. Yes, 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 yes. It means a lot of things which I have no time to develop. But you understood. I see that you understood. Because we are in it. We are all in it. This is the common situation, the common cultural situation of the people of the book, as the Quran called us. These are the people of the book who rely on the book in ways which are not yet critically studied and explained. And this is the interpretive readings are made by the interpreting community. Interpreting, the community which is in charge of interpreting. Interpreting community. And this process, which is a historical process, which is a political process, which is a cultural process, goes on through history and through different societies and different cultures, to which we have to pay attention. If we pay attention, and we have to, then we cannot just say Islam. We cannot just say Christianity. We should say, for example, French society, with its own history. What French society did with the Catholic expression of Christianity. What French did is totally different from what English people did. And you see the result. Anglican Christianity and Catholic Christianity in France, or Catholic Christianity in Italy, in Spain, etc. Then we think very concretely in each society, and we refuse to generalize as we are doing. That's why I do not agree with the dialogue like it has been initiated and like still it is practiced in many places, because it doesn't respect all this methodology. And it doesn't open the possibilities to feel committed, whether we are Western, whether we are Eastern, whether we are Chinese, whether we are whatever, we belong to any religion, we feel committed. We don't say, this is just for Muslims. It doesn't concern me. It concerns, because it is a problem of meaning.
At this time, please stop your machine and turn your cassette over for the continuation of this program.
Is meaning given from the heaven? As we say in the Quran, there is a metaphor, the metaphor of descent. The revelation descends from the heaven to the earth. So here is a metaphor. Like the Father is in the heaven. Jesus speaks of the Father who is in the heaven. This vertical look, it is a metaphor. And the meaning is given. It is there. It is collected and registered in the Holy Scriptures. We have just to read and to meditate the Holy Scriptures, and we jump in the meaning. No. Impossible. impossible, because we cannot go through any human discourse in a human language without facing all the difficulties of generating meaning. Meaning is generated. That's why meaning changes. It is not stable. It is not substantial. These are new statements made by social sciences, and traditional theologies didn't yet integrate these new definitions of meaning, which concern us, all of us. So you see, if we go this way, and we have to, and this way is not the way which is described by some political scientists, especially in America, that the 21st century will be the century of clashes between civilizations. You heard about it. You didn't. Ah, you live in a very peaceful place. You didn't hear the name of Huntington, Professor Samuel Huntington. He's a famous professor at Harvard who wrote an article about the clash of civilizations. He explained in this article that in the coming century we shall be overwhelmed and dominated by the clashes between civilizations. I think it is a very wrong approach of the issue. The truth is that we are living, all of us, on uninterpreted, uncriticized cultures. Yet uncriticized cultures. We are just beginning to move to an anthropology as a cultural criticism of all the inherited cultures. We are just starting to do this. The teaching that we give to our children, that we give to our students, many of the lectures we are giving are still closed on itself, on the culture of the country, on the culture which is to be found through a tradition of thinking special to each country. We are not moving to this open horizon where we would, all of us, revise, rethink in a critical way our relation to our own culture, to put our own culture in the same critical approach as we do for other cultures. Did you notice that in the West many people are very comfortable and happy to hear someone criticizing Islam as a tradition of thinking? But when you come to criticize something which exists in European tradition, Western tradition, then they are not as happy as this. So this is a very important condition to move from the formula of a dialogue, which cannot be something to give us how to unlearn. We have to unlearn what we learned at school, to clear up the space in our mind for receiving a new learning. Unlearn, I tell to my students, the first courses, I give them courses for unlearning what they learned in the secondary school, or what they heard or read in the books, to move to another space of thinking, another approach, especially of religions, because religions are still extremely important in shaping our sensibilities, in shaping our feelings, in shaping our emotional life, and if we do not master our emotions, it can lead us, unfortunately, to attitudes which we witness in many societies which didn't develop precisely this new critical culture, especially in Muslim societies. And there is a lot to say, to explain. Why do we have this violence since the last 20 years in many Muslim societies. This is a dimension of the problem I am raising. And if I insist on this necessity to move with new intellectual tools, to move towards a new approach of religions, it is more because I have been brought up in my country, Algeria, in which is happening a historical tragedy, for many reasons, because Algeria is very close to Europe, very much influenced by Europe. It is a Mediterranean country. It is not a Western, an Eastern romantic or obscure country. No, this is a wrong image about this country. Nevertheless, we see what is happening. It is a problem of civilization. It is not only a problem of religion. So you see how the approach of religions today leads us to a new approach of our civilizations. This is a program for Shatau, I cannot pronounce the name. Shatau. I cannot tell it. Okay, I leave a little time for questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
I don't know how many of you have had a chance to see the film Angels and Insects, but it reminded me of one of the things that Professor Arkun was doing. He was allowing us to open up an official closed corpus, and at first glance, the insect world might appear dark and fearful. But it's not possible to study angels until we lift up that official closed corpus. There must be a lot of questions. I'm going to go, as I was taught in the last 2 days, to go from left to right. So we'll start with the left first.
Yes, please.
Let me ask a very practical question. You spoke on the people of the book. Now, I speak as a Christian, and we have most Christian denominations make the Bible available. It has both within it. It has both the Jewish scriptures, we call the Old Testament, and the New Testament, the scripture, the Christian Bible, so to speak. Would it be possible to include a book which would have the Quran in it?
Of course.
How large would that book be then?
It's as large as history itself, because this is the development of history itself, and it is included in these books. And precisely this approach will allow for the first time to include the Quran in this series of books, Ancient Testament, New Testament, and the Quran, because it belongs to the same cultural area, the same historical development, the same religious symbolism. And all this has to be studied afresh without the postulates put by theological definitions. I'm not rejecting it. I respect it, but I tell only that methodologically we have to start from this and then come to theology.
Thank you.
All right.
Sir, you've left me puzzled as a result of your talk, and I wish you would clear up some things. I feel that you've overemphasized the political, or you've taken refuge there in explaining the backwardness of certain areas and the lack of dialogue. In France, there is dialogue between Jews and Christians. In America, there is dialogue between Jews and Christians, and we do have separation of church and state in the elementary school, in the high school, and in the most of the public colleges. Does that mean there cannot be any dialogue between Muslims or believers in the faith of Islam and Christians and Jews? That's item one. Secondly, with reference to what has been going on in the Muslim world, in the Middle East, how do we get some of the scientific method that you spoke of, this anthropology and all the others, into the schools, in Egypt, for example, where there's terrific opposition to the Coptic Christians. How do we get it in Saudi Arabia as well as the other areas?
Ah, yes, wait. I told, and I repeated again and again, that we are just starting. I am absolutely conscious of what you say. Unfortunately, this is the situations which we have inherited from our respective histories and our respective understanding and interpretation of our respective religious traditions. We have to change this. And we have to change it by a political decision, necessarily, because we depend, all of us, on a state which makes decisions to allow, for example, teaching anthropology at school and to pay the professors, to train professors. We need professors for this. We need the state.
But you have religious universities all over the Middle East.
Pardon?
You have religious universities.
Religious?
Yes, I mean...
Unfortunately, they have to evolve. These universities are not providing this modern teaching, especially the teaching related to social sciences, which I mentioned.
Yes.
Yes.
I agree.
We need to switch back again to other questions. Yes.
It is my understanding that the Muslims do not permit translation of the Quran into other languages. Is this understanding correct? And if it is, why is this not permitted?
The fact is that the Quran is translated in all spoken languages today. There are translations in French, for example. We have more than 30 translators, translations. So what exists is that the ulama, the church, if you want, those who are in control of orthodoxy in Islam, want always to control this activity and to say that the true Quran is the Quran which they teach themselves. It's not the Quran which is interpreted into a translation, because all translations are interpretations.
Right.
I'd like to thank you for the open-mindedness with which you approach this topic. I do have two issues, though, that are disturbing to me, and perhaps you'd comment on them. One is the narrowness of the view of Islam, of that of women and the status of women. The other is the idea that other religions cannot be tolerated or even to coexist. Could you comment on those?
Yes, absolutely. But I wish we had time for these questions. Yes, I think there is a need for a long seminar for tackling these questions. You see, here we are in culture. We are in problems of culture. The issue of women in Islam is ultimately a cultural issue, which is not particular to Islam as a religion, not particular to Muslim societies. It is an issue for all human societies again. How do we approach the issue of sexuality in societies through history? And how the status of women has been decided through the conceptions developed in different cultures about sexuality? And this existed before Islam existed, before Christianity came. Religions tried to tell something about the issue, which is basically an issue of organizing societies, giving norms to societies. So you see, this is an example of what anthropology can teach us to widen our approach of the problem. Europeans, Westerners, used to see, of course it's true, I am not denying that the situation of women today in Muslim societies is awful. It's awful. It is intolerable. But if if we approach it as we should approach it, because once we have said this, we have to do something to change this. How to change it? We have to change it by approaching the issue of religion and the status of women in religions, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Buddhism, in other religions. It's a whole issue. And even in modern culture and revolution. Do you know that France, which is my country, which made the major revolution for human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, do you know that women in France didn't receive the right for vote until 1945? So this problem is an enormous problem. We have to tackle it in a proper way, not only with patience and ideology. I have no time to elaborate more.
This is probably a good follow-up on that question. You gave the example of God the Father in heaven as an example of a metaphor of the vertical relationship with God. I wonder, as a woman made in the image of God, if we can also accept God the Father as a metaphor.
Yes, yes. Absolutely, absolutely. It's also related to the kind of cultures we have produced through our history. Even in grammar, masculine is used in certain circumstances more than feminine. All is shaped through this. This is culture. This is history. We have to revise this. We cannot live on what we have inherited from the past. And to do that, we have to use the tools appropriate to this kind of knowledge, which we call, in linguistics especially, the deconstructive study of cultures. Deconstructive study of, to deconstruct, to see how it has been put together to work as it does. And then we discover that it works on a wrong way, and that we got wrong conceptions which have shaped our sensibility, our emotions. So it is a move, a cultural move that we have to realize to make.
Regrettably, we have another event here in another 15 minutes, and I'm very sorry I have to close this up, but there is an open forum this evening at 7:15, and you're all welcome if you can. It's in the hall of...
Each summer, the Chautauqua Institution presents 9 weeks of artistic, educational, and religious programming. This multitude of intellectual programming, together with the recreational and leisure activities that abound, make the Chautauqua experience unique beyond description. One of the most important components of each season is the weekday morning lecture in the institution's historic amphitheater. For 119 years, thought-provoking speakers have challenged Chautauqua audiences, earning the institution a reputation as one of the world's leading lecture platforms. We now take you to the amphitheater where Dr. Daniel L. Bratton, president of the Chautauqua Institution, introduces the August 9, 1993 lecturer, renowned historian, author, and writer, David McCullough.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we can come to order, we'll begin this very special day at Chautauqua and on the Chautauqua Lecture Platform. I am Dan Bratton. I'm the president of this institution, and I'm very pleased to welcome what I am sure is the largest attendance yet this season to a morning lecture. This morning's lecture has been made possible by the generosity of Mr. and Mrs. R. Quintus Anderson. We do thank Quint and Sandy for their great generosity to make this exciting day possible for us. This year, we begin a new tradition focused on one of the most historic components of Chautauqua, its lecture platform. For over 119 years, 100 of them in this building, on this spot, The Chautauqua lecture platform has reflected and shaped American thought and culture. Leaders from around this world and country have come to Chautauqua to share their wisdom and insights about the issues of our day. 10 American presidents, including Mr. Clinton, have come to Chautauqua to speak of their vision for America and for the world. And it was here in the first week of the 1985 season, on June 24th, that Mark Palmer of the U.S. State Department and Oleg Sokolov of the USSR debated, and 5 years of truly historic programming began on U.S.-Soviet relations. History has been made and shaped here on this platform, and a more empowered citizenry has left this amphitheater and these grounds. Starting this year, Chautauqua will annually recognize and honor its lecture platform. Once each season, we will set aside the theme of the week and bring to this amphitheater a renowned scholar, writer, lecturer to deliver the Chautauqua lecture. And in so doing, we pay tribute to a great American tradition, the Chautauqua lecture platform. Later today, we will honor those people and families who have endowed lectures or lecture weeks at Chautauqua. This opportunity to expand materially our lecture program endowment is an important component of our current Chautauqua Challenge campaign, for that which we recognize today must be strengthened and assured for generations to come. And to those who have begun this task through their philanthropy over the course of Chautauqua's history, we offer our deep, deep appreciation. There was clearly one person to keynote the Chautauqua lecture series, and that person was David McCullough. We invited him to Chautauqua because he knows this institution. He has been here 4 times in the last 10 years or so. He's delivered at least 5 lectures during that period of time. But more than that, this man understands this place and what it's about. He is one of the preeminent historians of our day. He understands this country, its people, and he understands Chautauqua. I've never been more pleased in my time here to introduce a lecturer by introducing to you David McCullough.
I would like also to express my gratitude here at the start to 2 Chautauqua historians, Alfreda Irwin and Jeffrey Simpson, for their help in some of what I'm about to say, and to thank the staff of the Smith Library for letting me use the archival collection. This has been an interesting adventure for me, preparing my remarks today. Chautauqua, latitude 42 degrees, 13 minutes north, longitude 79 degrees, 29 minutes west, elevation 1,308 feet. Chautauqua, C-H-A-U-T-A-U-Q-U-A. It has the distinction of being both a point on the map and a word in the dictionary. An educational and recreational assembly with a program of lectures, concerts, etc., reads Webster's Third College Edition. And it is more. More of the utmost importance. Chautauqua is part of the American imagination. It belongs with Concord, Massachusetts, or Hannibal, Missouri, or Springfield, Illinois, as one of those places that help us define who we are and what we believe in. It has its own mythic force, Chautauqua does. And while there have been other Chautauquas so called, this is the Chautauqua. There is no place like it. No resort, no spa, not anywhere else in the country or anywhere else in the world. It is at once a summer encampment and a small town, a college campus, an arts colony, a music festival, a religious retreat, and the village square. It's all these, and it's none of these just. and there's no place with anything like its history. Here to this westernmost corner of New York, here by Freshwater in the Empire State, have come a steady stream of our presidents, beginning with Ulysses S. Grant in 1875, which was Chautauqua's second summer. God, education, the president, and the good life had met on the lake shore, writes Jeffrey Simpson. Chautauqua was a boom resort. The presidential total is 10, though not all were presidents at the time of their visit. They include, since Grant, Garfield, Hayes, McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, Taft, Hoover, Franklin Roosevelt, and Bill Clinton, which breaks down to a perfectly fair Chautauqua proportion of 2 Democrats and 8 Republicans. The parade of presidential aspirants has been greater still. William Jennings Bryan, Al Smith, Alf Landon, Henry Wallace, Norman Thomas, Bobby Kennedy. Alf Landon, it might be noted, in the summer of 1936, drew an even bigger crowd than Franklin Roosevelt. From this platform, too, have spoken many of the nation's great religious figures, DeWitt Talmage, Harry Emerson Fosdick, Gustav Gottheil, Reinhold Niebuhr, and such pioneers in American education as John Dewey, Harvard's President Charles W. Eliot, President Nicholas Murray Butler of Columbia, and William Rainey Harper, the founding president of the University of Chicago, who was also one of the driving forces of Chautauqua in its most formative years. Authors, journalists, historians, philosophers, inventors, industrialists, financiers, champions of social and political reform have stepped before Chautauqua audiences year after year in good times and bad. In wartime, depression, summers of privation and social upheaval, and summers of peace and plenty. Powerful historic words have been said from this very podium, speeches that not only move the audience at hand, but the whole nation at large. "I hate war," said Franklin Roosevelt here on August 14, 1936, the year that Hitler marched unopposed into the Rhineland. Fully 12,000 people filled the amphitheater that day in the face of a horrendous downpour. "We are not isolationists," he said, "except insofar as we seek to isolate ourselves completely from war. I have seen war. I have seen war on land and sea. I have seen blood running from the wounded. I have seen cities destroyed. I've seen children starving. I've seen the agony of mothers and wives. I hate war." And to this same stage have come hundreds, many hundreds of musicians over the years. Soloists, composers, dance bands, great symphony orchestras, a whole history of music in America over the past century could be written from the chronicle of Chautauqua performances. Imagine the music that has been played and heard in this very space. Victor Herbert and his orchestra, the Detroit Symphony, the Pittsburgh Symphony, Marian Anderson, Yehudi Menuhin, Jose Iturbe, Van Cliborn, Gladys Swarthout, Richard Tucker, Theodore Bekel, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Harvard Glee Club, Count Basie, Stan Kenton, the Glenn Miller Band, Lionel Hampton, Duke Ellington, Ray Charles, and Ella Fitzgerald. Now, it hasn't all been superlative, of course. Chautauqua is eclectic and egalitarian, as is America. The offerings have ranged far and wide and often not very deep. From Phillips Brooks or Buckminster Fuller to Rod McEwen and Pat Boone. And lately, I understand you've had a visitation from 10,000 maniacs. If themes of vivid originality have been expounded here, if the great throngs gathered in this place have known moments when the best of American intentions, our highest ideals, were expressed with memorable eloquence, there has also been a great deal of plain old-fashioned malarkey. A lot has been said that has been fatuous, preachy, silly, narrow, self-righteous, and a lot no better than oratorical kitsch. Of course, typically American, it has been said repeatedly of Chautauqua. Theodore Roosevelt himself offered that interpretation here on a summer day in 1905. He told his audience they were a typical American gathering. But then, thinking better of what he'd said, thinking perhaps Chautauquans might regard that as faint praise, he recovered himself and explained it was a gathering that is typically American in that it is typical of America at its best. The celebrated Harvard psychologist William James, a brother of Henry James, came to Chautauqua to lecture on the theme that Americans were in far too great a rush about everything. Too enamored with jerk and snap, he said, and he wound up not approving at all of the Chautauqua way of life. He called it a middle-class paradise without sin, without a blot, without a tear, and that, he said, was the problem. After a week here, he found himself longing for the dark and wicked real world again. This order, Chautauqua, is too tame. This culture too second-rate. This goodness too uninspiring. In this unspeakable Chautauqua, there was no point of the compass visible from which danger might possibly appear. Rudyard Kipling wrote of being Chautauqua'd to despair. Lectures were no way of learning, he insisted. People don't get educated that way. They must dig for it. He called this a lawn tennis tabernacle of the arts and sciences and concluded, I don't like Chautauqua. There's something wrong with it, and I haven't the time to find out. But if ever there was the perfect, the ultimate Chautauqua platform star, the very personification of what Chautauqua meant to America in that time, it was William Jennings Bryan, who spoke here just a few years after Theodore Roosevelt in 1907. Now, Bryan had already run twice for the presidency, and he was running again that summer. He was only 47, very much in the prime of life, and was widely considered as the most spectacular orator in the land. Besides, he had been in Nebraska a member of the Chautauqua Literary and Scientific Circle. And in his first appearance here, he caused a sensation. I am glad that I live in a country where a man of the common people, if he is worthy and able, can rise to the highest position in the land and retain it for a while. And when the people are through with him, can be put down. I'm glad to live in a country like this, even if one does take the risk of being put down before he is taken up. But in that same speech, he also said this: those who are responsible for the inauguration of this Chautauqua movement will influence people 1,000 years after today. It is impossible to calculate the good it will do. Those, therefore, who gave this thought to the world, impelled by heartfelt interest in the human race, have built themselves a monument that will endure when all the monuments of material elements have crumbled to the ground. Well, what about that? What about Chautauqua then and now? Chautauqua and American culture. What might be said here now from the vantage point of high summer 1993? First, as a beginning, it should be stressed that fundamental was the idea, the ideal, of building for the future. When Bryan said it is impossible to calculate the good Chautauqua will do, he was only amplifying what was not only a theme of the institution's founders, but an outlook held in common by everyone in his audience. Like American society as a whole, the focus was on the better tomorrow to come, not as a given, not as a birthright, but as a spur to effort and as a unifying mission. Chautauqua was designed to help everyone make the most of themselves. When Bryan, the great commoner, spoke of the common man rising even to the highest position, he was preaching the fundamental American creed, and he was preaching to believers. Now, the doctrine which Chautauqua teaches is this, wrote Bishop John Vincent, one of Chautauqua's worthy founders, that every man has a right to be all that he can be, to know all that he can know. Moreover, it is the duty of every man to help every other man be all that he can be. It is his duty. Chautauquans are open to the truth, he wrote. They believe in truth, God, and humanity. Chautauqua, he said, exalts education. Education, education for all was the banner they marched under. And in this, they were true, you see, true Jeffersonians. Chautauqua, it should be said, in this 250th anniversary of the birth of Thomas Jefferson, is a vivid expression of the Jeffersonian ideal. Any nation that expects to be ignorant and free, Jefferson said, expects what never was and never will be. The concept of adult or continuing education may be said to have begun right here. The idea of correspondence courses was pioneered here, along with what is now the nation's longest-running book club. But with this and bedrock was the ideal of service. He is the greatest who does the most good, Bryan preached that day. And if service is the measure of individual greatness, it must be the measure of a nation's greatness. In partnership with John Vincent at the start, as I'm sure you know, was the industrialist Lewis Miller, maker of farm machinery, a man who had made a fortune producing the famous Buckeye mower used on farms all over the Midwest and beyond. Miller was in fact the one who initiated the idea of Chautauqua. And in time, other familiar names in our industrial pantheon would be added to those who gave Chautauqua their blessing. Their blessing both verbally and financially. Edison, Studebaker, Heinz, the Browns of Buster Brown Shoes, all appropriately makers of products for the people, all very American. That an assembly so dedicated to education, to improvement, and to uplift should have also been in advance of social progress, of religious tolerance, women's rights, civil rights, or were at least willing to listen to the champions of such issues, should come as no surprise. There is but one way to solve this problem of the Negro, declared Booker T. Washington from this platform in 1896. And there is but one way to solve all problems, and this is God's way. Treat the Negro as a Christian gentleman, no more, no less. And there was huge applause in this very hall. Speaking again in 1906, he said more bluntly, whites can't afford to hold the Negro down. Over the years, one civil rights leader after another have walked to this platform to speak in the strongest words possible and with evident passion. Ralph Abernathy, Roy Wilkins, Shirley Chisholm, one after another. And of the many, many moving speeches delivered here, one of the most outstanding was given by Rabbi Gustav Gottheil of Temple Emmanuel, New York. The year was 1891. No Jew had ever before been invited to speak at Chautauqua. And here is how he began. As you have heard from this worthy bishop, this is the first living Hebrew that ever appeared on your platform. With the dead you have been acquainted before. You have heard their words. Indeed, they can never remain unheard wherever the high arguments of faith, of duty, of hope, of God occupy the serious minds of men. So closely woven are Hebrew thoughts in the world's thought. And their words fall upon our ear with the double authority of divine commission and the approval in the experience of ages. We still receive their words with reverence and gratitude. But the living can claim no exception from the standards which are recognized in the intellectual intercourse of man. He can take no shelter under the wings of his great ancestors because he may claim a lineal relation to them. He can only speak as man to man, as citizen to citizen, as fellow seekers after truth and fellow searchers after God. Speak to one another, if haply by their combined efforts they may feel after him. So I desire to stand before you here today. I would ask you to forget even the differences that exist between us, and to remember only, in order to put the whole matter into a phrase that will be most agreeable to you, that after all, I am but an Old Testament Christian, and you but a New Testament Israelite. Later came Rabbi Henry Berkowitz of Philadelphia, founder of the Jewish Chautauqua Society in 1893, now a century ago. Let me but ask you that what has been claimed on this platform tonight shall prove itself true, that Chautauquans are open-minded and open-hearted and will give us a welcome. Let us be of you in this educational movement. Let us have enough tolerance and generosity with one another that though we may disagree in obeying the dictates of our conscience in some matters of dogmatic and doctrinal religious questions, let us join hands for education in the true American spirit to make religion, as has been well said before, more intelligent and make recreation more respectful and more reverent. In the long struggle for women's rights, Chautauqua as a whole, though not always and not everyone, Chautauquans were perhaps most fervently committed and far in advance of the rest of the country. Many of the strongest, most courageous speeches ever made from this platform were on behalf of women's rights, the women's movement. Susan B. Anthony was foremost. Another was the Reverend Anna Shaw, who spoke in 1892 in answer to Bishop Vincent, who was not a believer in women's suffrage. But he was willing to let her speak. My friends, she later wrote, came out in force, and on the breast of everyone then flamed the yellow bond that stood for suffrage, giving the vast hall something of the effect of a field of yellow tulips in full bloom. She had her audience with her from the moment she stepped on stage. It is said that suffrage with woman interferes with woman as a woman. I believe that no law which binds me and prevents me from growth and development is in accordance with a divine will or in accordance with nature. And whatever makes me a dwarf in mind, in my life, and in the development of my being is foreign to the will of God, foreign to my nature, and therefore the law which says I cannot develop myself because I am a woman is utterly contrary to the highest will of God and contrary to the highest interest of womanhood. But then, the day afterward, came a very different kind of speech. And this, too, is part of the Chautauqua heritage, as is America. The speaker was Bishop James Monroe Buckley. He was a small, slight man, entirely bald, who'd been married 3 times. He was far traveled, and he was a gifted platform speaker, a power in ecclesiastical councils, I have learned from the Dictionary of American Biography. He hated the theater. No habit which does not imply a positive renunciation of mortality is more pernicious than that of the theater. And here's what he said in answer to the Reverend Anna Shaw's speech of the day before. There is a difference between the spiritual sex of a woman and the spiritual sex of a man. The peculiar controlling masculine element is the understanding, and the peculiar feminine element the supremacy of the affections. It is only because of the feminine soul as well as the feminine body that the family relation can be sustained. To govern in the state would unfit woman for her position in the family. The governing spirit would become a habit of the character. The element of authority would be substituted for that of the persuasive influence. And then he got to what was really on his mind.
At this time, please stop the cassette and turn the cassette over for the continuation of this program.
Population. Element of authority would be substituted for that of the persuasive influence. And if women are entitled to vote, all the Roman Catholic women of the country will be entitled to the right. What will become of our public schools under these circumstances in all the cities and towns where there is a large Catholic population? All of the colored women in the South will have a vote, and there are millions of them. All of the foreigners that come here will have the right to vote as soon as they are naturalized. All of your domestics and servant girls will have the right to vote, and you can imagine the results this will bring. My reading has taken me through the speeches of so many who appeared here, and one who came to Chautauqua again and again, seven times altogether, if I count correctly, was Eleanor Roosevelt, who, as late as 1933, just 60 years ago, was giving an impassioned speech on women's rights. But to give you a sense of how, at times, from this platform, some extremely striking, stirring, worrisome pronouncements have been made, I want to read you what she said that summer day, July 26, 1933. And imagine if the First Lady of the land were saying these things to us today. Now we have come to the place in history when we are deciding how our whole civilization is going to develop. Remember, this is 1933, the very depths of the Depression, the worst year ever. It may be that no one is ever again going to make as much money, for instance, in this country, as they did during our great years of prosperity. It may be that many people are not going to reach certain heights of luxury ever again. It may be that employers are going to have to be content with smaller returns on invested capital. It may be that the interest on investments, which many of us have, is never going to be as great again as it once was. And undoubtedly, many people are going to suffer. This is the unfortunate part of all change, that some suffering usually attends the change. The only thing we can do is to try to direct change in such a way as to minimize the suffering as far as possible. Now, we look about us today in America. We look at American culture today, the state of the American spirit, if you will, and the signs are extremely distressing. It isn't just that so much is being done that is vacuous and vulgar, but that there is so much that we are not doing. Why have we abdicated our role as founders, builders? What is it we are doing that we want to be remembered for in time to come? Where in our time are the great civic buildings and structures that surround us today, built by our predecessors? Where is our Metropolitan Museum, our 42nd Street Library, our Brooklyn Bridge, our St. Louis Arch, our Chautauqua. Where is that word posterity in our vocabulary today that the founders of this institution perceived and lived by as bedrock? The word so often evoked in times past to give a sense of mission, unifying mission to society. What has happened to the state of oratory in the country as an expression of national ideals? How is it that with all the babble and all the talk about the talk about the talk in last year's political campaign, last year's presidential election, that there was not one memorable speech delivered? Not by any of the candidates, not a sentence, not an idea expressed that anyone will ever remember or need to remember or wish to remember. Is the answer in the word appearances? That we've come to the place where image is all, as one commercial rants, image is everything? If there's no eloquence in our politics and little candor and little thought, is it perhaps because none of that's necessary anymore, given the market? If the culture is market-driven, can we expect the politicians to be any different? We must address this. We must see the link, the overlap, the kinetic bond of politics and culture, history and culture. History and culture are forever intertwined. It's very possible, in fact, I think likely, that culture drives history. And yet we separate them in our society, in our schools, in our curricula, in our television productions. We teach the history of science, the history of medicine, the history of art, the history of music, the history of law, the history of finance, the history of industry. And then over here we have something called history, with a capital H, which leaves only the military, social issues, and politics, as if that is the whole of history, which of course it is not. Culture is what matters. And one measure, surely, of what culture is, what we care about, is how we spend our money. Now consider this one simple fact. Libraries all over the country are shortening their hours, laying off staff, and putting a freeze on book acquisition, or actually closing their doors. The cuts are almost certainly far greater than during the Great Depression, during which, I must point out, not one single library in this country closed. Not one. And in my state alone, in Massachusetts, recently 20 public libraries have closed. In California, more than half of all the high school libraries have closed in the last 6 years. Schools are cutting back drastically on art and music programs, or eliminating them altogether. Yet, interestingly, if you call the statistics specialist of the Department of Education in Washington and ask how much is spent on high school music or art programs, he can't tell you. He doesn't know. He can tell you what is spent on something called support services or faculty acquisitions, and something else called non-instruction, but nothing on the arts or the humanities. A few years ago, there were 3 states in this country who did not require the teaching of American history at any level, grade school or high school. As of now, there are 5 states in the country that do not require the teaching of history in the grade schools or the high schools. University professors on the left insist on what is known as the politically correct, and their counterfeits, their counterparts on the... Here's to Freud. Their counterparts on the right, off campus and on, decry them as thought police. The debate rages. Is this the new McCarthyism? Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Meantime, according to an article in last week's Boston Globe, 48%, in other words, nearly half, 48% of all students on university campuses in the land haven't the faintest idea who Joe McCarthy was. And how in God's name have we arrived at the point where some 20% of the nation, this best, supposedly best informed population ever, think maybe the Holocaust never happened? How have we arrived at that? The television sets go night and day, and network programming gets steadily more atrocious. Public television is in the doldrums. Money for programming is nearly impossible to find, even for proven quality program. Fact and fiction blur everywhere, on television, on the movie screens, on the printed page. A biographer lifts the work of other writers, makes up dialogue, and says he's only pushing the outer reaches of the envelope, whatever that means, and nobody seems to care. So here we are at Chautauqua. What can we pull from this place, this experience? Well, one thing surely is the old idea of the rise of the common people. We Americans, not common in the sense of being low, but being citizens of the United States of America. We can return to the old idea of quality citizenship. Voting, taking part in the census, putting your dime in the parking meter. Service is not just an individual attribute, but a national way of life. We can try and find some new, worthy, ennobling, unifying mission for the country, something quite beyond just balancing the budget. That's important. It needs to be done. But surely we are about more than just that as a nation. Education, books, music, art, history. History is all around us here today. It's not just part of the atmosphere. It's part of the character of this place. It's why, to a very large degree, we come here. There's no other place like it. When you're here, you know exactly where you are. If you're on Highway America, Supermarket America, Airport America, Shopping Mall America, whether it's in Florida or New Jersey or New Mexico, how in the world do you know where you are? When you are present here with the past, you are present with a body of ideology, with a volume of thoughtful, considered attention to the nature of the American experience. And you can draw from it. You need to draw from it. The worse things get elsewhere in the world, the better it seems here. The automobile is not present. We walk, we visit. I'm even told there's something called the Chautauqua Minute, as in, I'll be back in just a minute, I'm going to get the newspaper. And you return an hour later. I am on the newly appointed and elected to the Board of Directors of the National Historic Trust, National Trust for Historic Preservation. And one of the efforts being made under the new director's leadership, Richard Moe, is to think not just about saving individual buildings of historic importance or cultural value, but whole groups. groups of buildings, whole communities. This is an approach to the handling of space by architects everywhere. It is a very healthy and very interesting development, and could lead to more than just saving our heritage, our architectural heritage, our idea of who we are. Now, the time is going to come very soon when everybody's going to go home from Chautauqua. You're all going to pack up and go, and the days will get a little shorter and a little cooler. The leaves will start to turn. The place will be empty. It won't be anything like what we feel here today. And the chief reason for that is that you will be gone. You are Chautauqua, just as you are the nation. And it does no good to blame politicians. If we don't like them, we can remove them. It does no good to say that they are behind the curve of what we want. They have always been behind the curve. That's the way the system works. They will move as we want to move. And it's very valuable to come here and be among friends in the quiet of this so pastoral, by contrast, so pastoral a setting. It's not just good for the brain, it's good for the soul. And I would like to close with something wonderful that I found in a tiny little book written in 1854, 20 years before this institution opened for its first summer. It's a book called The Camp Meeting Manual. And of course, the lineage of Chautauqua comes directly from the old Methodist camp meetings. The author was a New York Methodist preacher named B.W. Gorham. And listen to these lovely words. The truth is, human life needs to be dotted over with occasions of stirring interest. The journey asks its milestones, or rather, if you please, its watering places along the way. Our nature requires the recurrence now and then of some event of special interest, something that shall peer up from the dead level of existence, an object for hope to rest upon in the future, an oasis in the desert of the remembered past. On you go.
Thank you, David. Words, they fail me. That was magnificent. If you'd like to take a few questions and come back to the podium there, I'll be happy to receive a few, and we'll spend a few more minutes together. I think you've implied this, but I'd like to ask you what you feel the greatest single threat or challenge there exists before this institution and for before those of us who make it happen.
I think that it has to do with our perception of our past. So many people go through life thinking that all that's around us just happened, that it didn't take initiative and imagination and effort, and that it can be blown away, it can be discarded, taken to the junk heap very rapidly, never ever to come back again. It's not just ignorant to be indifferent to history. It's rude. It is being ungrateful, rude toward all those people who work so hard to give us what we have here in this nation. And we have to not only be the custodians of that, we have to improve upon it. The people who built this institution, who built this country, believed fervently, no matter what their religious denomination or ethnic background, that it was put upon us by
society and by participating in this way of life to make it better than what we found it, to improve the world, to give of ourselves. Generosity. Generosity. The happiest people I know, both from the past and in the present, are people who are generous, not just with money, but with themselves, with their talent, with their efforts. The gregarious person is someone who goes out, who is giving of herself, himself, to others. I specialize in long answers to questions, so I'll stop now with that.
How would you suggest that we convey and teach the ideals which you talked about to our children? How can Chautauqua play a key role in their cultural and community and humanitarian lives?
I think we have to begin in grade school, and we have to begin by teaching the teachers. It isn't just that so many schools now are not even requiring the teaching of history, but the quality of the teaching and the quality of the books the children read is going steadily downhill. And I think the fundamental way to teach history, whether it's in the classroom or on the screen of the television set or in a book, is very simple. Tell stories. What happened? Why? What happened next? Who were those people? How did they do what they did? Why did they do what they did? Where did it happen? In what season? Under what conditions? It's about life. It's the most interesting subject imaginable. And the pull is everlasting once you get started.
Specifically speaking, how can we overcome the decline in our national culture which TV is creating?
Well, I tell you what I think about television. I've spent a lot of time in the last 12 years working in public television. I think I know something about it. My feeling is that it's as if we've discovered fire and we haven't quite yet learned how to work with it. We haven't quite learned how to use it. Its potential for educating people, for teaching mothers how to take care of their infant children, for enlarging the sense of possibilities that people have of what they can make in their life, is all infinitely greater than we've even put a toe into. Take, for example, this thought. Our television networks, our television producers and writers haven't found out yet how do you present, how do you handle good news. Bad news, of course, can hold an audience just like that. So can good news. So can good news. What they do now is they load on the bad news for the full half hour, and at the very end, a little chirpy smile comes on the host, and he says, tells you some little anecdotal thing that happened out in South Dakota or somewhere, and there's a little flurry of music, and off they go, and you're meant to feel very cheerful. Well, good news of importance, good news that is revealing and of value is happening every single day, and yet nobody reports it.
A couple of questions about Harry Truman. First of all, as you came to know this man, where is there an overlay of his value system with the value system of this institution, as you understand it? And secondly, as you came to know him well through your research, in relation to your early understanding of him, what surprised you most about him?
Harry Truman would have loved Chautauqua. He didn't know it, but he was a Chautauquan, I think. First of all, he was very much in the William Jennings Bryan tradition of the Democratic Party, on the one hand, and in the William Jennings Bryan outlook on American life on the other hand. Bryan was his boyhood, among his boyhood heroes. He is the only president of our century who never went to college. But he's also one of the few presidents of our century who never stopped reading. History He once said that all readers can't be leaders, but all leaders must be readers. And he read history and biography over and over. He also said something wonderful. He said, the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. There it is, you see. So simple. The only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. The second part of the question was about...
Well, as you came to know him well through your research, yes. What surprised you most as you proceeded through your research?
Well, I think there are three things. First of all, that, and most importantly, that he was a far more thoughtful, intelligent, well-read, considerate, sensitive, sentimental, and hard-working man than I had any idea, or I think that the country ever understood. He withheld that side of him, too, to public display, and I think that was a failing on his part. Harry Truman was no hick. He is the only president I know who used to go regularly to the National Symphony because he loved serious music, and if they were playing one of his favorite composers, Chopin or Mozart, he would take the score with him. Secondly, he was not an accidental president. And what I found out and what I was able to find in the record, verifiable information about the Chicago Convention of 1944, really was an eye-opener to me. They all knew then that Franklin Roosevelt was a dying man. They all knew his days were numbered, and that they were there at Chicago not just to pick one president, but two presidents. So therefore, that battle for the vice presidential nomination is really quite dramatic at the time and very, very important to us historically. And the third point, I think, is that Truman, we are inclined to think, only now emerges as the figure of decisiveness and strength and integrity, and that nobody saw that then. Well, they did see that then, not as clearly and not as uniformly as today. But General Marshall, Winston Churchill, Dean Acheson, Arthur Kroc, the head of the New York Times Bureau in Washington, Henry Steele Cumminger, the great historian, all were saying, this man is really something, and he is going to go down in history as one of our greatest presidents. They all said it. Churchill said that he more than any other single human being saved Western civilization. And he said it in front of other people, including Harry Truman. So that was a shock. I was also surprised that he took a drink of bourbon first thing every morning. For those of you who are interested, it was wild turkey. And as Lincoln once said about those who were carping about Grant's use of whiskey, maybe we should send a barrel of wild turkey to Bill Clinton. I'll tell you one thing for certain. If Harry Truman took a sip, he definitely swallowed.
There's one more thing I like about Harry Truman. My friends, you've witnessed one of the high points in the life of this institution. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to the 1993 Chautauqua Lecture by David McCullough. If you would like more information on the Chautauqua Institution, please call us toll-free at 1-800-836-ARTS.